This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 10th of April 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London on Tuesday, the 10th of April. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up in the next hour, as an ex-KGB officer wins the election in the Georgian breakaway region of South Ossetia, we'll be asking whether Russia actually wants to cozy up to its regional neighbours. We'll be dipping into the world of business with Jonathan Openshaw. Today, we'll hear how the letterpress could be the new way to make a big impression. We'll also speak to the deputy editor of the British Medical Journal, Trish Groves, about whether scientific research should be free to access. Plus, why politics is never far behind when it comes to culture in Israel. And if that weren't enough to ignite your interest, we'll be asking whether the stamp collecting market has stuck itself in the right-hand corner of a first-class mess. All that, plus some great songs from our global playlist for you to enjoy, all right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. Yes, indeed, there's a lot to come your way, but the first thing to come your way is Mr. Jonathan Wheatley with the news.
Monocle 24 News. Syrian troops have killed at least 31 people and insurgents have killed six soldiers hours before a deadline for President Bashar al-Assad to withdraw his forces. Activists say 26 people, mostly civilians, were killed in a Syrian army bombardment in the city of Homs. It comes as a deadline for Syria to withdraw troops and heavy weapons from towns today passes by, with Kofi Annan's peace plan to stop the violence in real jeopardy. Meanwhile, the United Nations has warned that the turmoil in Syria could threaten neighbouring Iraq. Martin Kobler is the head of the United Nations Assistance Mission for Iraq.
Continued violence in Syria is fraught with risks that could have dangerous spillover effects on Iraq. It could affect the fragile balance of power and increase communal tensions in Iraq. In addition, the violence in Syria has already started to affect Iraqi refugees in Syria.
Dozens of students have held a demonstration in Pakistan's biggest city of Karachi today, condemning a $10 million bounty on Pakistani Islamist leader Hafiz Mohammed Saeed, suspected of masterminding attacks on India's financial capital and its parliament. US authorities placed the bounty a week ago, but 2 days later he was openly wandering across Pakistan's military garrison town of Rawalpindi. Britain and Japan have today agreed to jointly develop and build defence equipment, the first time since World War II that Japan has concluded a weapons-building deal with a country other than the United States. Hours before Cameron's plane touched down in Tokyo, Japanese carmaker Nissan said it would spend $200 million to build a new hatchback at its British plant. The British Prime Minister explained why Japan was so important to Britain.
Well, we need to get our economy moving, and we need to make more, we need to sell more, we need to export more. Japan is the third largest economy in the world. It's a huge customer for Britain's goods. It's also a massive investor back into Britain. And the news today that Nissan is going to be making a new hatchback in Sunderland is going to create thousands of jobs in our country. So I'm here to encourage investment into Britain, but also sell things to Japan.
News from Norway now, and Anders Behring Breivik, who killed 77 people last summer, has been found sane in a psychiatric report that contradicts an earlier one that found him psychotic. A final ruling on his mental condition will be made near the end of his trial, which starts next week. The latest report could give the judges grounds to sentence him to prison if found guilty. Descendants of some of the 1,500 people killed on the Titanic have gathered at Southampton Docks here in England today to hold a service commemorating the departure of the ship 100 years ago. A commemoration service for some 650 relatives was held near the berth from where the Titanic sailed, and a minute's silence was held. The English port city lost 549 people in the 1912 disaster when the White Star Line ship hit an iceberg and sank in the Atlantic on the 15th of April 1912 on her first voyage to New York. Barbara Corbin, whose great uncle Ernest Theodore Corbin died on the Titanic, paid tribute to the service.
I just found the whole experience very moving and very touching, and I'm just so pleased that I've been able to share in it.
And finally, staying here in England, an 87-year-old grandmother who's almost deaf was given a noise abatement order for playing Glenn Miller and Frank Sinatra hits on her radio too loudly. Neighbours claimed they endured 18 months of hell as widow Georgina Sims from Gosport banged her walking stick on the wall and played music day and night. And those really are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
And thank you very much, Jonathan, for those. I've got a few more headlines here, which are on the Wednesday morning papers from the Antipodes. Let's start with the Sydney Morning Herald. It has this, two stories about asylum seekers. One is about a group of 10 followers of Falun Gong, the Chinese religion, who have been picked up and taken to Australia. But it seems they don't actually want to stay. They want to go on to New Zealand, and they're being dealt with very sympathetically. It does seem as though New Zealand is going to take them. But meanwhile, 120 Afghans, all Hazaras, who are a kind of a group of Afghans who are often persecuted in that country, they've made their way all across Asia. They've got on a ship and they've tried to make their way to Australia. But the ship was looked as though it was going to be to sink out at sea, and it was rescued by a Singaporean tanker as their boat foundered on the high seas. And those people, it doesn't seem, will actually make it to Australia at the moment. That's the Sydney Morning Herald. Going over to New Zealand, I think it's anyone listening in New Zealand, hello, but I'm afraid your papers have some very local news this morning. The New Zealand Herald leads with the story of a clamped driver who decided to fight back and apparently is not going to have to pay his fine. That's a whole page. And then we go on to the press, and the headline is Teen Takes Hose to Blaze. Well, there you go. So slightly more news of bigger merit coming your way, I think, in the moment. But anyway, it's now 18:06 here in Midori House in London, and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
And spring traditionally is the season of big weather contrasts. Very changeable weather from day to day in Europe this week. Whether you're in London, Geneva or Berlin, you're bound to encounter rain or shine. A fair bit of snow in the Alps over the next 24 hours too, and after that it'll continue to snow on and off rest of the week. How about some warm weather? Well, even in Greece, it's not that warm. And here's Wednesday's city outlook. In Athens, 17 degrees, partly cloudy. Prague, 16, with sun and showers. In Amsterdam, it's 12, some sunshine with a rain chance. And in London, around 13 degrees, with rain showers expected too, maybe even some thunder. What's happening across North America? Well, second half of the week, again, fairly big contrasts between the east and the west coasts of the US. Washington State down to central California, cool, rain is expected most days. Deep into the continent across Nevada, on the cool side too, some snow in the Rockies. The Atlantic seaboard, however, is sunnier and will become warmer as the week goes on. So on to Wednesday's city outlook. In New York City, 11 degrees, sun and showers, warm end of the week. Atlanta, 14, partly cloudy. San Francisco, 13 with rain. And in Vancouver, some rain Wednesday too, around 11 degrees. And a look at some Asian business centres now. Hong Kong, it's looking warm the next few days. Warm but not overly sunny. Highs of around 26 degrees. In Tokyo, rain on the way for Wednesday, 17. And in Singapore, it's 30 degrees with sun and tropical showers. And that's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Thomas, for that. Your global weather report, always well received here in Midori House. And you are indeed listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
South Ossetia is not a nation that makes the news very often. In fact, it's not even recognised as a nation by most countries. Only a handful of nations, including crucial ally Russia, recognised it as an independent state after it separated from Georgia in 2008. But despite this, South Ossetia has continued to act autonomously ever since. And yesterday, an ex-KGB officer, Leonid Tibilov, was named as victor in the presidential elections just held there. Perhaps unsurprisingly, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has congratulated Tibilov on his victory, although Georgia has claimed the election to be void. But why is Russia interested in this tiny region of 30,000 people? Author and Caucasus editor for the Institute of War and Peace, Oliver Bulow, joins me on the line now. Oliver, let me just correct you, from the War and Peace Report, from War and Peace Reporting. I just wanted to pick up, could you just tell us a little bit about this KGB officer who's won the election?
Well, I think the most important thing to stress is that when you say he's a KGB officer, you conjure up an image of someone who might be rather like Vladimir Putin, for example, himself, an ex-KGB officer. That's actually, although true, is it completely misleading. The reason why he has won this election is nothing to do with his background in the security services. The reason he's won this election is because he isn't connected to the previous government of South Ossetia. He has been, I mean, he has been in government in the past, but not in the last sort of 4 or 5 years. And the reason why that's important is because since the war of 2008, when Russia and Georgia actually went to war over the status of South Ossetia, Georgia attempted to regain control over it and Russia drove Georgia out. Since then, an enormous amount of Russian aid money has poured into the region in order to rebuild it, to build military bases, to pay for pensions, for healthcare and so on. A lot of this money, I mean, it's very difficult to say exactly how much, but certainly a large proportion of it has been spirited away by the former government into foreign bank accounts and to buying luxury cars. As a result of this, the former government is immensely unpopular. And Tabilov, owing to the fact that he's not connected to that government, is sort of the default popular candidate of the four candidates who were available.
So just tell me, that we said in the introduction that there are 30,000 people who live in South Ossetia. Since the war, it kind of broke away from Georgia. How has it kind of governed itself? Is it actually, in effect, just governed by Russia, or is it actually an independent little enclave that somehow manages to struggle on its own?
Well, basically, in the late 1980s, early 1990s, when the Soviet Union was falling apart, Georgia, the Georgian people, in their first sort of act as a sort of democratic-minded people, elected a Zvir Gamsakhodia as their president, who was a complete psychopath. And as a result, he sort of made it extremely difficult for anyone in Georgia who was not ethnically Georgian. The South Ossetians, who had been living up to that point entirely peacefully and normally within Georgia, naturally objected to this. He and the subsequent government sent in the army to try and restore control. And because the army was so appallingly incompetent and amazingly corrupt, they actually managed to lose, despite the fact that, as you say, South Ossetia's population is only a few tens of thousands. What this meant was that since 1992, South Ossetia has run itself effectively as an independent state. It was, you know, in very good relations with most of Georgia, but it was still, you know, had its own government, its own elections, and which was not recognised by Georgia. In 2008, as I said, Georgia attempted to regain control over it to end that sort of self-proclaimed independence, and that's where all the problems crystallised. Russia, which had up to that point effectively ignored South Ossetia to a large extent, intervened on its side and it became then a Russian protectorate. So although now it does have, the vast majority of its budget does come from Russia, it's still it still has its own government. Russia has recognised it as independent. And as you said in your introduction today, the Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, did actually congratulate the winner, saying that he hoped this would be a new beginning for South Ossetian democracy.
Do you have some nice musical accompaniment to go with your speaking, I think, in the background?
I have a toddler here who's
yeah, that's very good. And just returning to South Ossetia, can you just tell me, do you think that this will see the region become ever closer tied to Russia? Because no one else really recognises it. Does it have any option other than really one day to be sucked into Russia?
Well, as it stands, the Georgia is insistent that South Ossetia is a rogue province and must return to Georgian control. Since the South Ossetians themselves don't recognise that as a possibility, what that means is the only option is to continue on its current course, which is ever greater integration with Russia. I mean, the most presidential candidates favour greater integration with North Ossetia, which is a Russian region inhabited by more Ossetians, their ethnic kin, north of the mountains within Russia. So were that to happen, then that would inevitably involve a degree of further integration with Russia. But this is not to say that it will cease to be considered by Russians and by Ossetians themselves an independent country. But it may become ever more of a protectorate. At the moment, its security is entirely guaranteed by the Russian military, so it is a protectorate in all but name, and it probably likely to become even more so.
Now, at the time of the war took place, that many people felt that the Russians were just so kind of piqued at kind of President Saakashvili's behaviour, they despised him so much that was the reason they kind of backed the South Ossetians. If there was a kind of change of regime in Georgia, do you think that the Russians might be a bit more sympathetic to South Ossetia returning to Georgia? Or do you think that actually there is more being played here and that they actually don't care about being friends with their regional neighbours?
I think they do care. They certainly, and they've certainly said in the past that they'd like to see a new president to come in and replace Saakashvili. But that is assuming, and I think it's a miscalculation by the Russians, that anyone who replaced Saakashvili would have any different policy with regard to Abkhazia and South Ossetia. The vast majority of Georgians, certainly in my experience, are overwhelmingly in favour of Georgia regaining control over these two regions. And so that does naturally constrain the freedom of movement of any politician. And that's not least because a very significant part of the electorate, the precise number is disputed, but certainly 200,000 or 300,000 is made up of refugees from Abkhazia and South Ossetia. And the only prospect they have of ever returning to their homes, from which they say they were ethnically cleansed, the separatist regimes say that they fled, the only prospect they have of returning to their homes is if Georgia regains control. So, you know, basically, as it stands, it is very difficult to see any movement in this issue of any kind for the foreseeable future.
And finally, Oliver, could you just tell me, how does South Ossetia make any money, 30,000 people? I hear they've been associated with, you know, the drugs trade, with guns, with even kind of trafficking of people across the borders. Is this true, and does it have a kind of a friendlier face as well?
In the past, when the border with Georgia was open and it was possible just to catch a bus from Georgia to South Ossetia. And basically what that meant was there was no border between South Ossetia and Georgia, and then there was no border between South Ossetia and Russia. So, like you say, it was an extremely convenient place for anyone with something to smuggle. I think The Economist memorably described it as a mafia clan with a piece of territory attached. Since the war and the closing of the border with Georgia, that lucrative business has sadly ended, sadly from a South Ossetian perspective. What that means is that essentially it makes money now from Russian aid and from remittances from relatives who mainly work in Russia. It's very difficult for them to make any other kind of money. They do have a sort of slight agricultural sector. I suppose conceivably they might have a future in skiing. But no, I mean, it's not a place that's ever likely to rival Monaco as a centre of the international wealthy.
Oliver Bellew, thank you very much, and thank you very much to your assistant as well. That was great. You're listening to Midori House. We're about to enjoy some music from Rasheem Murphy before we talk letterpressing with Monocle's business editor, Jonathan Openshaw. So stay with us.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop-in-shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly business briefing, looking at the most inspiring people, places and ideas from around the world. Whether it's a bookshop owner in Toronto with a smart new business model, a fast food entrepreneur taking Japan by storm, or a local bank CEO providing microfinancing in Kenya, our correspondents and editors are on hand to provide insight into self-started success. Each week we'll be talking to enterprising people who have taken the leap and followed their dreams to set out on their own.
This is not just purely a business. This is a lifestyle. It's fun. It's great. I wake up in the morning, every morning, excited about what are these crazy ideas going around in my head.
From branding your company to finding startup financing and surviving the tough times, we cover the full range of what it takes to turn an idea into a thriving business. All told through personal stories from real people finding success by following their ambitions.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
This is Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck, and this is Rasheem Murthy with Footprints.
Footprints in the morning snow. You got me rocking, rocking.
That was Roisin Murphy with Footprint. And talking of prints, you see, this is a really bad link, but I'm going to go for it anyway. And talking of prints, we're going to talk about letterpresses in a minute, because it's Tuesday here on Midori House, which means it's time to talk business. And I'm joined in the studio now by Jonathan Openshaw, Monocle's business editor. Welcome, Jonathan.
Loving your links there, Angie.
I know, it's a good one, isn't it?
That's strong. That's
and
good.
we're going to talk about the world of the letterpress. And,
yes.
And why has this caught your eye?
Well, as you know, on The Entrepreneurs, we're big fans of letterpress. We featured...
that's globally known, actually, that you're big fans of the letterpress.
I love a letterpress. But we featured Greenwich Village Letterpress, which is a company I think you came across out in New York, set up by two siblings. And just recently, I think it was announced yesterday by the craft site Etsy, that their the number of letterpress items on their site had jumped to 22,000 this month, so beginning of April, which is more than triple that of a year ago. So it's this kind of interesting thing that in the digital decade, this oldest form of analog print, you know, going back to the Gutenberg Bible, 15th century printing, that this has actually boomed alongside a digital boom. So it's kind of finding these niches of analog within the industry.
Now, I know we're going to be joined on the line at the moment by somebody who is actually a graphic designer and printer. But for your reading of this story, why do you think that it has kind of taken off in this way?
Well, I think there's something in it being an affordable luxury, which is, you know, it's not actually a big expense to get things, you know, to get a nice hand-printed letterpress item. It's like that kind of daily coffee that you can go to, and you can get that kind of hit of analog or hit of something quality when the world around you maybe is slightly digital and slightly flippant. And also, I think people want to see the craft behind things. They want to feel like they're connecting with a tactility in their media. And you know, the whole media market has been shaken up, and as things settle out, yes, there's lots of room in the digital at one end, but then at the other extreme, there's some really healthy niches in a slightly more premium product, and people are willing to pay for that.
And just before we go to the interview, it is intriguing, I think, that balance between people who, you don't have to be in one camp or the other. I think you meet people who are in, you know, they have their iPhone and they love everything digital in one part of their life, but they then actually like getting a thank you letter that's on a piece of print, or they actually still like reading a magazine, or they like playing a record on a record player when they get home. And it's strange how people are very good at kind of playing with old school and new school media at the same time.
Yeah, and as you said, it happens across all sectors, all industries. You're seeing it in music with vinyl, you're seeing it in printing. So, yeah, a really interesting one to watch.
Well, we're joined on the line now from New York by graphic designer Donatella Madrigal, who's one of many people who's branched out into the letterpress industry. Donatella, thank you for joining us. Could you just tell us a little bit about your adventures in letterpress and how that began?
Hi, how are you?
Very good, thanks.
I started letterpress how to print about 4 years ago. A couple of years out of college, and I was working full-time, 9 to 5, always in front of a computer, and I started to experiment with things that were not just a screen. I started doing silkscreen, and then I found my way into a letterpress shop, and I loved it. I loved the quality of the paper. I love having control over, you know, not just the design, but the colors, the pressure that the paper had. And basically, I was doing that on my free time. And about a year and a half ago, I decided to start a greeting card line and posters. Started getting custom jobs, and that's what I've been doing as a side little business, hoping to one day be my full-time business.
And Donatella, can you just tell us a little bit about the actual technology and the processes that you go through with letterpress printing? Because maybe a lot of people, they might know what a letterpress print looks like, but they might not be completely aware of the processes that go into making one.
Well, most of the designs that I do, I first make a design on the computer, and then I get a plate made. It's a plate that is made of plastic, and that you put on a base for the press, for the letterpress, and then rollers apply pressure on this plate and the paper, and then you apply also color, and it gives you a nice relief impression on the paper. It's it's a complicated process that I'm still learning after 4 years, but it's very rewarding.
And could you finally tell me, do you think that this is something that's particularly popular in New York? Do you see lots of people, you know, buying cards, wanting things made on letterpress?
Yes, actually. I have a small proof press at home that I can do small runs, but for larger quantities, I go to a letterpress print shop that I rent a press, and the place is always filled with people. It's always different people, and, you know, you start talking to the people around you, and everybody is loving letterpress and doing it very, very often. Also, I sell wholesale at a couple of stores, and people are very drawn towards letterpress more than digital. If you are sending a card on the mail, which is already an old-fashioned thing, I think that you prefer that it not be digital and that it has a little bit more soul.
Well, Donatella, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about your business. Jonathan, just coming back to you, it was interesting. I saw that when we were doing some of the research on this, it was saying that Evander Cook Press, which is one of the best that you can use for letterpress, in the late 1990s, they were selling in the US for $500, and today they're selling for $10,000. Mm. It really is remarkable, that rush into a quality print. And another thing that I also noticed when I was in New York recently, there's a really lovely bookshop that we like called McNally Jackson. And actually, when you go there, the kind of range of greeting cards they have, it's unlike anywhere you go in Europe. In London now, if you try to buy a greeting card, it's in some horrible chain, and it's kind of some kind of laminated piece of rubbish. But there was an amazing number of cards by dozens and dozens of different companies. So it's obviously quite a kind of a little craft movement going through the kind of big city America.
Well, I think the interesting thing for me as well, as you mentioned there, that you could, 10 years ago, you can buy a letterpress for $500, now it's $10,000, but still you're not looking at really kind of prohibitive costs to break into this. And there are, you know, that's a premium press, but there's things out there where you can actually just start this up as a small scale operator, which means that lots of people can kind of, a little bit like Donatella, can dip their toes in the market while they're still holding down a day job. Donatella works in digital, but's doing this on the side, and then kind of build a bit more of a kind of brand around that, and then launch a fully analog brand. So it's an interesting area for small-scale operators and entrepreneurs as well.
Well, thank you, Jonathan, for coming to tell us all about. And then we should look out for your show, The Entrepreneurs, which premieres at 1900 on
Wednesday. So good. That will be tomorrow.
Good. Well, I shall let you go off and complete that. You're listening to Midori House.
Music to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 is your song.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Now, in the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be asking whether scientific research should be free to access. We'll find out whether Gunter Grass won't be visiting Israel anytime soon, and we'll ask whether stamp collecting has got carried away. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much. Syrian troops have killed at least 31 people, and insurgents have killed six soldiers hours before a deadline for President Bashar al-Assad to withdraw his forces. Activists said 26 people, mostly civilians, were killed in a Syrian army bombardment in the city of Homs. Dozens of students have held a demonstration in Pakistan's biggest city of Karachi today, condemning a $10 million US dollar bounty on Pakistani Islamist leader Hafiz Mohammed Saeed, suspected of masterminding attacks on India's financial capital and its parliament. US authorities placed the bounty a week ago. Britain and Japan have today agreed to jointly develop and build defence equipment, the first time since World War II that Japan has concluded a weapons-building deal with a country other than the United States. News from Norway now, and Anders Behring Breivik, who killed 77 people last summer, has been found sane in a psychiatric report that contradicts an earlier one that found him psychotic. A final ruling on his mental condition will be made near the end of his trial, which starts next week. The latest report could give the judges grounds to sentence him to prison if found guilty. And descendants of some of the 1,500 people killed on the Titanic have gathered at Southampton Docks here in England today to hold a service commemorating the departure of the ship 100 years ago. The English port city lost 549 people in the 1912 disaster when the White Star Line ship hit an iceberg and sank in the Atlantic on the 15th of April 1912 on her first voyage to New York. And for the moment, those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Jonathan. You're listening to Midori House, and I'm Andrew Tuck. Now, there's a campaign afoot to break the stranglehold of scientific journals and allow academic research papers to be shared online for free. Over 9,000 researchers have already signed up to the campaign, and now, in the UK, the Wellcome Trust has said that it will launch eLife, an online journal where it will give free access to work that it has supported. To explain the background to the so-called academic spring, we have on the line Trish Groves, Deputy Editor of the British Medical Journal. Trish, thank you for joining us. First of all, could you tell us why there has been a backlash against these journals and how it began?
Well, it goes back a long way, actually, because open access journals have been growing over the last decade or so. In fact, there are now more than 5,000 open access journals and more than 200,000 articles already published that's completely openly accessible to everyone on the internet. So this is not a new idea. What's happened, though, recently is that some mathematicians have said that they're getting fed up with not being able to access work in journals that their universities don't subscribe to or that they can't afford personal subscriptions to. And they're particularly frustrated when their own work gets published in a journal that isn't openly accessible because they can't even read their own papers. So it actually started with a blog a couple of months ago by a mathematician saying he was fed up with this situation. And it, good old Twitter, of course, spread it around very quickly. And we're now up to more than 8,000 signatures saying that many researchers are planning to boycott traditional journals. So they won't send them articles, they won't do peer review for them, and they're trying to persuade their libraries to stop subscribing to these journals.
Now, just as a little bit of background, I was looking today at the amount of money, for example, that a university would spend on academic journals during a year, and the average spend for a university is into the millions often. Yeah. And is that also a driver that, as we see cuts happening, as academic institutions have to be more careful about their spending, are you finding that the impetus for this campaign is also coming from organisations that are saying, look, we just can't afford these prices anymore? Because it's not like, but I think the public thinks buying a journal costs a few pounds, but this is thousands and thousands of pounds, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. But actually, it also costs thousands of pounds to fund research and to do research. And that's what universities do, and hospitals and so on, like the National Health Service in the UK. They do tons of research, and it costs money to do it. It costs money to get it peer-reviewed by experts who say, yes, this is new enough, it's important enough, actually this is scientifically sound enough to publish and to share with other people. And publishers, to be fair, have done a good service over the years in providing that peer-review service, in making the articles very readable, making them available either online or in print, and distributing them very widely. So they need a business model. They somehow, that's got to be paid for, that service. And the alternative, which is what the new journal eLife is going to do and what many journals already, including the BMJ and BMJ Open and lots of other journals do, is instead of saying we're going to charge you to read the journal, they say to researchers, we're going to charge you for the service we provide, which is the peer review, the editing, the decision making, all of that, and actually hosting your articles and distributing them either in print or online or both. So it still costs public money. It's just that it's paid for differently. So the Wellcome Trust, which is a charitable funder of research, is saying what we'd like to do and what we're already doing is to give researchers part of their grant to cover the costs of open access publishing. So journals still make money. They just make it a different way. They make it by being paid once an article has been accepted, and they're being paid for the service they have provided.
And can you just tell me, yourselves at the British Medical Journal, do you find this is a challenge that you're having to confront? And what do you do about giving free access?
Oh, well, actually, we've been at it for longer than anybody else in health. I mean, the BMJ, British Medical Journal, went fully online in the mid-90s, and everything was completely free. Over the years, our business model's changed, and that wasn't sustainable for the whole journal to be free, but we've kept all the research completely free and open. We do charge researchers, once their article has been through peer review, if it's, you know, good enough and it's been accepted, we then say, okay, if you've got a grant that will cover the open access fee, then please send it to us so that we can keep doing this, we can keep publishing research with open access. If you haven't, don't worry, we'll waive the fee. And a lot of journals do that. Everything else in the BMJ, there's loads of education and comment and journalism that's aimed at doctors, and that isn't freely available, but it's available to anybody who either has a subscription or is a member of the British Medical Association or gets the journal through their library at their hospital, their university, and that's the case all over the world. And many journals, including the BMJ, are also completely free to countries which have a low GDP. There's a scheme which is partly run by the World Health Organization which makes thousands and thousands of journals completely free in poorer parts of the world. So, you know, there are lots of ways to come at this. Journals are still providing a useful service. It's a question of how you pay for that. And the question you asked earlier on about the high cost of subscriptions for universities and hospitals is a valid question, because are publishers levying a fair price when they charge libraries, academic libraries, for their journals? And how is that balanced against actually paying for publication up front once it's been peer-reviewed?
And just tell me, we referenced it there as a being called the academic spring. Do you think there is a kind of a change in kind of feeling about how information should be shared in this day of the internet, and that there's a belief that perhaps some of these journals are a bit too secretive, and in fact the information should be available even to members of the public who perhaps have a passing interest in some of these topics?
Public who will be, trying to find a physics article or a maths article, to be fair. But all kinds of people want access to articles about medical research and about, you know, what's the best kind of healthcare to have and what's the best medicine and all that kind of thing. So, yes, there's a sort of moral argument which goes beyond just the academic one for health research. And absolutely, there are all sorts of reasons why it's good for researchers to be able to easily access not just articles but actually also data, you know, raw data, for the public, for policymakers, all sorts of people to be able to readily access information. So, there's definitely a really strong movement towards open access for sort of important public and moral reasons. But as I said, it needs to be sustainable, so you need to find good ways to support that. And there is a good way, which is this payment for the publishing and peer review service. But obviously it's not a vanity publishing thing. You don't say, here's a fiver, publish my paper. You say, here's my article, please, you know, consider it in the normal way. And most of these journals have very high rejection rates. But the articles they do accept, because they've made it scientifically, there's then a fee due. But as I said, many journals are waiving that fee and are still managing to make enough money to keep going and to develop more open access.
Well, Trish Groves, Deputy Editor of the British Medical Journal, thank you very much for joining me here on Midori House. Now, after this short break, we'll be asking why culture often leads to politics when it comes to Israel.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes and quips of the week, tune in to The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about making things better. Each week, I'll take you on a rollicking romp through the worlds of design, craft, architecture, fashion, and graphics, with factory frolics, building tours, product tests, and studio guests.
They're beautiful, they're functional. When you use them, they are completely poetic. They lift that activity, whatever it is, to another level. It makes you aware of the quality of what you're doing.
Tune in every week to hear the stories behind the things that we live with. That's Section D, premiering each Tuesday at 1900 hours London time, here on Monocle 24.
This is Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. It's 1842 here in London.
The Nobel laureate Günter Grass found himself in hot water this weekend. He's written a poem entitled What Must Be Said, which criticises Israel for threatening to attack Iran. The Israeli government has responded by banning Grass from entering the country. Here in London, there's been another controversy afoot. An open letter has been written by several leading actors which criticises the inclusion of the Israeli National Theatre Group, Habima, in the 2012 Cultural Olympiad. They will be performing Shakespeare alongside 36 other nations at London's Globe Theatre on the south bank of the Thames. So why does Israel find itself both banning and being banned on the cultural stage? Well, joining me on the line now is Monocle's Budapest correspondent Adam Labor, whose book City of Oranges explores some of the complexities of modern Israel. Adam, thanks for joining us. I wondered what your initial take was on the Günter Grass controversy. Do you think that it was right to ban him from entering Israel?
No, I thought it was completely ludicrous. I think there's far too much talk when it comes to Israel of banning and boycotts. Israel bans him. Israel's also banned Norman Finkelstein, a controversial American academic. People want to ban Israel. They want to boycott Israel. As you say, they want people, the Israeli theatre company, to not take part in the forthcoming festival at the Globe Theatre in London. It's very strange. It seems to elicit very powerful reactions.
And just tell me, do you think that what we're seeing is a response actually from Benjamin Netanyahu's government rather than actual the Israeli public at large? Or do you think that the ban did actually reflect a kind of common consensus within Israel?
Well, I think there's no common consensus on anything in Israel, which is one of the reasons why it's such an interesting country. But I mean, it's a consensus perhaps on the right, yes. I mean, the ban's been implemented by the Netanyahu government, by a couple of ministers, by the interior minister. And these are very right-wing, very polarizing figures. Also, I think it's supported by Avigdor Lieberman, the foreign minister. But, I mean, there's certainly a big outcry in Israel about this, that this is a really idiotic thing to do. I mean, my feeling is it would have been far more productive to bring him over to meet some Israeli writers and to see what a vibrant free press there is in Israel and what a great literary scene there is. That would have been much more useful than banning him.
And it does seem to slightly fall into a trap of, the Israeli's government is often very unhappy when people call for, either academic boycotts or cultural boycotts of Israel. Yet here they are kind of, in effect, doing the same thing in reverse.
Yeah, exactly. That's a very good point. I mean, there's a big movement around the world to have academic boycotts of Israel. And the Israeli government, understandably, is outraged about that because Israel is a country in the Middle East where there is proper academic freedom compared to most of its neighbours. And now they're doing the same thing. It reflects something about this situation of Israel and Palestine. It just makes people want to start banning and boycotting everything when it's really not a productive way forward at all.
Have you looked at the offending paragraphs in the Günter Grass poem?
Yes, I mean it's just a sort of I don't understand why it's elicited such powerful reactions. I suppose because it's a German writer, and he has written about how he also served for a time in the SS, and I guess that understandably makes a reaction. But if Israel seeks to be a normal state within the world, the government has to learn to react a bit more normally. I mean, you can't still keep having these reflexive reactions. I mean, Günter Grass is very old. Writer now, he's very eminent, and there's much better ways to respond to this and to maybe get him on board to see the complexities of the situation and tell him, well, you can't come in because you've written a poem. I mean, if he's being banned because of his war record, that should have happened years ago when he confessed to his war record.
And can you tell me, does it surprise you that Israel finds itself in this situation so often? Not in the banning, but both people calling for boycotts and for it kind of turning its back on arts organisations, it doesn't feel a very supportive of the Israeli position. It's funny because I guess other countries have equally controversial politics, yet somehow they don't quite kind of fall into the trap all the time, do they?
No, it's something about Israel seems to make very strong reactions in people. I mean, if we look at the other theatre companies that are coming to the Globe Theatre Shakespeare Festival, there's people coming from Hong Kong, from China, from Russia, from Turkey. I mean, all of those countries have worse human rights records than Israel, certainly in terms of freedom of speech. And there's no protest about this whatsoever. But because the Habima Theatre Company has played a small number of events in occupied territory in the settlements, they're calling for it to be banned. But thankfully, the Globe is saying, no, we won't ban it. Now, the Globe says, look, we've got a Palestinian company coming. We're going to have an Israeli company too. I mean, and that's the way it should be. Instead of banning and boycotting, people should be given a voice.
And it seems especially odd kind of banning Shakespeare, which it seems to be one of the kind of one playwright that perhaps unites everybody together over a common cause and a common way of expressing things, and who controversially had lots to say about both faith and about kind of people's countries as well.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Shakespeare is a universal, he wrote in English, but he's a universal playwright. He's the world's playwright, as you say. And many of these companies that are coming are playing in their original language. I mean, there's going to be performances in all sorts of languages. And the whole point of Shakespeare is his universal appeal. That's why he's so popular, so many hundreds of years after he wrote. He deals with essential human truths. And I think those truths should be discussed in all the languages of the world by theatre companies from all over the world.
And perhaps finally, you could tell me, do you think that Israel finds itself feeling a little bit sensitive at a kind of government level at the moment? It hasn't quite kind of won the global support they might have wanted for its kind of stance against Iran. People are kind of tugging at its jacket, trying not to let it kind of step forward and punch old Iran on the nose, as it were, politically. It's just found things a little bit tougher going, hasn't it?
Yes, I think they're feeling a bit beleaguered. Yes, I mean they often feel beleaguered in Israel, understandably. But at the moment, yes, there are some doubts about what Iran's really up to, whether it's trying to make a bomb or not. It says it's not. Israel says it is. I mean, no, there's a fairly strong argument. It seems to be pointing towards the fact that it might be. But there's a lot of doubt in America and also within Israel. A former chief of Mossad, Meir Dagan, said that Israel should not attack Iran because it's not, even if they do attack it, it's probably not going to stop the nuclear program, and the spillover effects and the other consequences would be horrendous. So I think you're seeing a sort of knee-jerk reaction from a rather right-wing government at the moment that is unfortunately is what Israel has, and I hope that sometime in the future there'll be a rather more conciliatory, moderate voice running the country.
Well, Adam, I'm very glad that we were able to give you your free speech here on Monocle 24. Thank you very much for joining me on Midori House. It's time for a song now, and this is going to be Banner by Lights. And that was Banner by Lights. Now, Britain's famous for its collectors, and with the Olympics and the Diamond Jubilee on the way, the variety of stamp collections produced will make 2012 one of the busiest in terms of new releases. You might have thought that this was good news for stamp collectors, but it turns out there's trouble brewing in the philately community. They're now arguing that with the Royal Mail because many feel that it issues far too many stamps and that it is flooding and destroying the market. Joining me on the line to discuss whether the trade in stamps is about to come unstuck is Hugh Jeffries, editor of Gibbons Stamps Monthly. Hugh, thank you for joining us. So let's cut to the chase. Do you think that the UK is putting out too many stamps?
I think that stamp collectors have been saying that not only the UK, but nearly every other country in the world has been putting out too many stamps for years and years. And it's just been getting worse and worse. And finally, it looks as though the message may be getting through to the post offices concerned.
And what's caused the revolt at this point? Why are the stamp collectors up in arms, as it were?
Well, that's a good one. It's, as I say, it's been It's been brewing for years. I suppose it could have something to do with this being Olympic year and Diamond Jubilee year, both of which would quite reasonably be an opportunity for issuing stamps to celebrate events. But of course they come on top of a regular issuing program, which is already quite challenging for people who are trying to keep their collections up to date. And really this does look like being the most expensive year yet. And you know, finally collectors have seemed to be making their voices heard. And post offices are listening.
Now, when I was a kid, I used to like to get the kind of first editions of these stamps, and you could have them sent to you by the post office, and have the, you know, the unfranked and the franked versions. And I guess that when you were a kid, you tried to keep up with the numbers that were coming out. Is it just almost impossible? Is it this huge amount of money now for, you know, for a young collector to kind of keep up with the amount that's being put out in the UK, for example?
I would say that the chances of a young collector would have to have. Particularly generous parents or grandparents, I would say, to keep up to date. It is very expensive, especially if you're buying the first day covers and as well as the unused stamps.
And just tell me, you're obviously at the cutting edge of the higher end prices that we see for stamp collections. If someone was starting a collection, do you think it's almost worthless them now collecting the kind of stamps that are being put out in the UK, for example?
Well, that's an interesting one. While most of the demand at the moment amongst collectors is for early stamps in fine condition, and prices there seem to be rising pretty much all the time. I mean, Stanley Gibbons sold a stamp for £550,000 only a couple of weeks ago. Penny blacks seem to be rising in price each year. But modern stamps, no, there doesn't seem to be all that much interest. But on the other hand, so few people are buying them, or perhaps I should say comparatively few people are buying them, that actually they will become quite scarce if there is even a slight increase in demand could show that current stamps are actually turn out to be quite a good purchase in the long run.
And out of interest, what did I need £550,000 to buy?
You would have bought a penny red from a particular printing plate 77, issued in 1858. The plate wasn't supposed to have been used. I think 9 examples were known. Most of the ones that are the whereabouts of which are currently known are in museum collections and therefore never likely to be on the open market. And the one that we had was the finest out there on the open market and probably the only opportunity that a really serious collector would have to buy that great rarity.
I love it, Hugh, that in the world of stamps, your mistakes are worth more than your successes, in a way.
Oh, yes, that's always been the way.
Good. Well, Hugh Jeffries of Stanley Gibbons, thank you very much for joining me. You've been listening to Midori House. And indeed, that's all we have time for on this Tuesday edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Katie Bilboa. The researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was also here looking after proceedings. The Monocle Daily will be back at 2200 London time. That's in 3 hours with Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller. Up next, after the news, you can enjoy the latest episode of Section D with Hugo MacDonald. So stay tuned for that. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow with Christian Yeo.